Good morning, friends, and welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is December 21st, 1984. I'm Gail Malloy. Each Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. We'll spend the next hour with James T. Hutchison, Sr., known as Hutch. He's best known for his work in Alaska aviation. Our program this morning is brought to you by Larson's Jewelers, the Riverboat Discovery, Denali Chiropractic Clinic, Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, Sophie Station, Two Rivers Lodge, and Interior Signs. You're listening to Paul Rosenthal's variation on Alaska's flag song. Good morning. In the studio with me this morning for part two of our interview on Meet a Pioneer is Hutch. Good morning, Hutch.
Morning, Gail.
Nice to have you back again. Our time was cut a little bit short last week, and plus you have a lot of stories to tell, so we've had you come back, and I'm sure glad you were able to do that. What we're going to do in the first few minutes is kind of catch up just a little bit on some of the things we covered last week and then get to the point where we ended at and start from there. I'd like to mention again that you were born on February 14th, Valentine's Day of 1900, and that was in Williamsburg, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And you came to Alaska in 1919.
Right.
And that was with the
Army.
Okay. And where did you go?
Went to Fort William H. Seward at Mount Haines. Spent about 3 months there. And then as my company went by Haines, why, we got aboard and came on up to Valdez, and I spent the rest of my enlistment there.
Uh-huh. And you met your wife there?
Yeah, I was discharged in 1922.
And met Helen, and then you moved in May of that
year. And went on to Fairbanks.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you came, tell us again why you came to Fairbanks.
Well, I played a little ball down in Valdez there, and I heard that they had a chance to play up here, you know, and I wrote to the manager of the baseball team in Fairbanks, and I got an answer, by golly, and I told him where I was from, and he was from the same town in Pennsylvania, Warren, Pennsylvania, and by golly, he sent me $100 to come on up, play ball, and he told me that we could find me a job up here. That was great. Mm-hmm. Just out of the Army.
I forget what position you played. What position did you play?
Shortstop.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah, right up there.
Now, did you get paid to play baseball?
Yeah.
Huh, how much did they pay you?
Oh, no, I didn't get paid here, but I did get a job.
Oh, okay.
With the independent mill and then with Sampson, and that's where I stayed.
Yeah. Now, after you came up here, you bought your house in 1925.
Right. 23, I bought it.
Oh, 23.
I made a mistake there. I was going to tell you about that.
Ah,
yeah, 23. Yeah, because my daughter bawled me out about it. Because she was born in the house in 1924.
Is that right? And which daughter was that?
Marion.
Marion. And you have how many children altogether?
Eight.
Eight children.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, did you have, okay, your first child, she's your first, Marion?
No, my first is Jim.
Oh, okay.
Next is Ruth.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and then Marion.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And she was the first one born in this house,
yeah,
there on first, mm-hmm, which you still live in to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Yep. Okay, by the way, back in 1923 when you bought the house, do you remember what you paid for it?
Yeah, it cost me $75, and I got I think the lot was 60 feet by 90 feet and kind of tapered. There was a wedge. And I was able to buy a lot behind the house and a half a lot on the right side, on the east side. So I got a pretty good spread down there now. Lots of cars parked, motorhomes, boats, what have you.
Uh-huh. Lots of the kids' things, huh?
Right.
What difference is in the house now than it used to be?
Well, I had to build on, of course, as the youngsters came along. The house got smaller, and I added on an upstairs and a kitchen, and then Mrs. Hutch and I dug the basement, and I put a big furnace in, and we've had a lot of fun.
Gee whiz. Now, what was the deal on that house? When was it built? What was the story on it?
I think it was built for the manager of the steamship company. There was about three boats parked right close to the house there. There was a, what they call the marine ways or whatever it was, and they had a couple buildings. They had a carpenter shop and a storage shop, and I think this house was built for the manager.
Okay, so right across the street from you, where the power plant is now, of course, that wasn't there. It was the shipyard then.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Anybody who looks at the old photographs can certainly see a difference along the Chena River shoreline of Fairbanks. But your house is still there. I guess the view has certainly changed. We ended yesterday kind of right in the middle of an important story, and it was the story you were telling us about the search for Ben Eielson and Borland. What was Mr. Borland's first name?
Earl Borland.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had told the story about the Nanook was a Russian fishing vessel that was selling furs.
Yeah, the Nanook, Carol.
The Nanook, to a company operating out of
New York. Yeah, the fellow that owned the boat was from New York. Swenson.
And they were, I see, Swenson. And anyway, this was in Siberia, and it got iced in, right?
Yeah.
And so they were hiring local pilots to fly these furs out.
Right.
Okay. Well, you pick up from here then and kind of catch us up on how Ben Eielson. Oh, first of all, tell me real quick. Ben Eielson was a teacher here in town, right?
Yeah, he was a teacher.
He was a school teacher. And how? And did you play basketball with him, right?
Right.
Tell me that story before we go on with the rescue.
Well, the basketball court was on 4th Street, right across from where the Northward Building is now. It took in about a half of the block there. It was a big, big building. And I remember stories that they used to flood it in the wintertime sometimes, used as a hockey or a skating rink. But we were playing basketball there. And Ben, the high school didn't have quite enough players to make a team, so they... the Moose team, who I played for, and there was one other team, or maybe one other team, I think it was the Signal Corps. We all said that Ben could play, make up. Christ, we never won a game after he started playing. This one night I came home with a big patch across my nose, and we'd been playing basketball that night, and Ben... When I went down, I picked the ball up, and as I come up, I hit Ben in the head and broke my nose.
Oh. Oh, no.
So I had to go to Doc Sutherland, and he put a patch on it, and I come home. Miss Hutch said, "What happened to you?" I said, "Well, I busted my nose." Sir, you're right. Shouldn't play basketball anyway.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're going to take a break here to acknowledge the sponsors that helped pay for me to pioneer. And I wanted to tell something, Hutch. We better tell our listeners what all the commotion and noise is behind us right now. See that big snowplow right there about 30 feet from us? Clearing the lot across the way. Mm-hmm. Friends, bear with us. That's what's causing all the background noise. I think they might be getting done here pretty soon. But Hutch and I will speak real loud. We'll be back in a moment. Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
He is waiting for you.
gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna tune to 660. Never thought my heart could be so yearning. Wanna hear good radio. KFAR in Fairbanks.
Welcome back to Me to Pioneer. I'm Gail Malloy speaking with Pioneer Hutch. Hutch, before we go on with our story about the Ben Allison rescue, I wanted to mention that you're instrumental in the mechanics part of aviation in the history of the Alaska, and you are, tell me if I'm correct on this, the oldest licensed A&E mechanic in Alaska?
Maybe. I don't know. I never checked into it, really. And according to the numbers on my license, it's pretty late. It's pretty early.
Do you remember that? What is your license?
9381. It's pretty old.
9381.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, that's pretty interesting. That's neat. And you were cited, as we mentioned in our last show, by you received the state award in the field. Okay. Well, tell us the story. Ben Allison was flying with his mechanic. All the pilots took mechanics along in those days, right?
Well, and on this particular trip, they did, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that was Errol Borland. Okay, what happened?
Well, of course, they were based there at Teller, you know. They were flying into Teller. And I imagine that they took the furs into Nome, then back to Teller. They flew to Nome and unloaded and then flew back to Teller and parked there because they had a big bay there to take off on, lots of snow, ice. And from the name of Dorband, he was a pilot too with the company, and he was flying a Stinson, and him and Ben made a trip, and they made a round trip, and everything worked fine. And on the trip, they decided that they didn't need to use skis on account of the ice.
Mm-hmm.
So they changed. Took skis off and put wheels on, and they sit around there, and I guess Dorband kind of got edgy, and it finally took off, and Ben took off about 30, 40 minutes behind him, and in an hour and a half, Dorband was back, and Ben never did come back. So they waited and waited, and nothing came in from the Nanak on the radio, you know, to see if he got there, and he didn't get there that night. So, of course, they knew darn well something was wrong. So they waited the next day. They figured he might have been forced down and would get into the Nanak or back to Teller, but he never showed up and never showed up. Several days went by, and finally they decided that something was really wrong. So Joe Crossan and decided to go over, and we had a WACO we used there. The company had a WACO. And Harold Gillum, he was a fledgling pilot just starting in. He only had about 50 hours. And he wanted to fly a Stearman we had. Well, they hem and hawed a little bit, but let him go. And the two of them took off and went to Teller. And shortly after, they flew off and went over to Siberia. But they didn't make the Nanak on the first day. They had to stay at some native, with some natives.
Uh-huh.
Chukchis, they called them. And the next day, they both heated up, and they fired up, and Gillum took off, and Joe took off. They got separated in the clouds or a snowstorm or something, and Gillum kept going. And Harold came back and landed. He spent the night there, and he got worried, though. Gillum never showed up back, you know. So here Gillum made it on through to the boat. He was up the boat. And next day, Joe came into the boat. The weather cleared up, and he made the boat. He was sure glad to see that Gillum made it.
Oh, yeah.
And they started a search. Well, the weather closed down then. And I think for a whole 3 weeks or so, they couldn't fly. Terrible. And in the meantime, it snowed so much that it covered the airplane up.
The crash?
Yeah.
Site. Now, what time of year was this?
Hmm?
What month of the year was this?
What year?
What month? And what year?
Oh,
yeah.
It was December, I think.
December of?
November, December. I think it was November.
Of 1929?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, and they kept fiddling around there trying to go, and they couldn't go, and they finally could get search in a day, an hour a day or so, you know. And they'd come along in spring, January, I think, and the sun come out a little bit, and they caused a shadow on the eye, on the snow. The wing sticked out on the of the snow, and it caused a shadow, and Joe saw it, and they fiddle around. They were flying about 5 miles apart, and they would go and come over, and they both landed and went over, and sure enough was the airplane. And they went back to Nanak, and then the news was flashed around that the airplane was found. Well, then it, from there on out, it was a real search to find them. The guys was in the airplane, because it was a real wreck.
And they were thrown out of it,
huh? Yeah, and it took them days to dig. They had to dig through 4 or 5 feet of snow, you know, packed hard.
Huh.
And the Russians had a boat froze in the ice about 5 miles from the Nanak. And they recruited all the help they could off of it. And the Russians come flying in with a couple of Junker airplanes, and they helped. And they finally found them and flew them back to Fairbanks.
There was something really amazing about that. They discovered eggs?
Yeah, they had bacon, and they had a case of eggs in the airplane. They were taken up to the Nanak. Men did. And by golly, they dug these eggs out, and one of them broke in that case. And the people that manufactured the case wanted it back, so they flew it all the way from Siberia back to Fairbanks and shipped the darn thing outside.
Huh.
Yeah, the people that built the thing wanted it as a, probably a, I don't know, memento or something.
Huh. Now, those are raw eggs, and not a single one of them broke. That's
but
really an amazing
frozen,
story.
Of course, you know,
by the time
no
they
good,
found them, yeah. Well, then, how did you happen to get involved and get out to the site of the crash? Because I know you have pictures of it.
Well, the Canadians came then. They, American Airlines organized the big search, and they had 3 Fairchilds shipped up. And then they got a whole bunch of Canadian pilots who were supposed to be versed in Arctic flying, skis, and all that stuff. So they came up here, and they were well organized. They had a Major Deckard who was in charge, and a Captain Oakes who was a second in command, and they had a guy by the name of Swartman was a pilot, and Pat Reed was a pilot, and they had Bill Hughes, a mechanic, and one mechanic from Nova Scotia, and I never could remember his name. Well, anyway, they all come into Fairbanks with their airplanes, and we put them together up the hangar. They were in crates, you know, and they brought them up, and we uncrated them and put them together. And on the first test stop, Sportman cracked his up, busted it. The engine quit on takeoff.
Huh.
So then we only had 2. So then, by golly, Pat Reed was flying one, and they sent Anchorage for Matt Nieman, and he came up, and he flew the other one. And Harold Gillam had busted up his airplane a little bit over to Nanak, so they wanted Hutch to come over and do a little welding on it. So I was to go with Pat Reed and his Fairchild. So we took off, Pat Reed and Bill Hughes and I and one, and Matt Nieman and a fellow named Macaulay, and Major Deckard in the other one. Well, we flew by New Lato Fine. It was good weather. And all of a sudden, we run into a snowstorm and a pass from Caltag going to Unicleet. And, Pat Reed, he decided to land. He landed in the Ungolic River, for heaven's sake. We busted 5 feet of the wing off.
Uh-huh.
And went through some water and an overflow and all kinds of stuff. Deep uh-huh. snow. But he was able to get out of it and taxied up on a little spit there, a little bar, and we stopped. And Bill Hughes and I jumped out as quick as we could and went back up the tracks and picked up the pieces. Because we didn't have no pieces, you know. We had some repair stuff, all right. And we come back, and there we were. Drained the oil and put the motor cover on. And the Fairchild had folding wings. You could fold the wings. So we folded the wings and took everything out of the fuselage. And Mrs. Wiener, who was Earl Borland's wife's mother, she had put us up a great big box of good food, sandwiches, and you wouldn't believe what was in there, cake, and we had three bottles of rum. That was just for medical purposes, you know. So we had a little blast of rum, I guess, and then we ate some sandwiches and crawled in this airplane, went to bed. Well, you can imagine three guys in an airplane, you know, trying to sleep. That was terrible.
Oh.
The morning woke up, you know, and everything. The ceiling of the airplane had icicles hanging down, 6 to 8 inches. That's from your breath, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had to break them all out and take sleeping bags out and hang them under the wing. They were damp. It was still snowing, and we started thinking about fixing the airplane, and we had three gas cases with us full of supplies. And this thing seemed to work out. I don't know about these things, but you know, we had all the airplane repair stuff in our airplane. The other airplane that was being flown by Hemlin had all the engine parts and repair, cylinders and spark plugs and all that stuff. So what we did, we emptied out all the boxes and then took pieces of the boxes and nailed the spars together and built ribs out of some willows and put the fabric on, and I monkeyed with the aileron. The aileron was busted on the corner, and we patched the thing up.
Is that the little flap?
Oh, yeah, a little bit.
Little flap on it, okay.
Then we sit there, waited.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of Chuckseys come by, or natives come by with their dog teams, and try to get them to send one back, but Pat didn't want to do it. Had no reason. So we taxied the airplane back up the river a long ways, fired it up and taxied it way back up the river, turned it around on some tubing I'd had along with me, take over Siberia. And we just drained the oil again, covered everything up, folded the wings, and sit there another night. Well, on Saturday, just a week from the time we landed, the weather was nice and clear, right, you could see for 40 miles. So we heated up and folded the wings up, got everything going, and we got in, and away we went.
Now, how long were you out there?
A week, 7 days.
And nobody knew anything about your whereabouts, because you had no radios in planes then.
No radios.
I understand that your mother back east wrote to the federal government, somebody, and instigated a search for you?
Yeah, she sent a telegram to, or she got a hold of the congressman from Pennsylvania, I guess, and he got a hold of the one from Alaska, and they were going to get the Marines and everybody out searching for us.
Oh.
You know, the Army and the Navy and the Marines.
And how many children did you have at this time?
Five.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And your wife had... Nobody knew where you were.
No. Pretty.
Well, so you did get out of there then.
Yeah, we got out in fine shape, went to Unicleet and landed.
Uh-huh. Now, did you go straight home?
No, I went to Nome then. We flew across. We stayed 4 days in Unicleet to rest up after this ordeal. We were in terrible shape, you know, according to the pilot. We went on to Nome.
But you actually were doing just fine.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We went on to Nome, and we fixed the wing, took the wing off, put it in a big barn there. They had a big barn. They had some big barns there. And we put it in there and spliced this barn, built new ribs and fabric, patched it up, put it back on, and Pat flew over to Siberia with it.
Uh-huh.
And he hauled passengers back and forth. And on one of his trips in, his last trip in, after they had found everybody and they hadn't either found them. They're pretty close to it. But they built a big fire. They were celebrating something, I don't know, and they had a big fire going, and Pat thought it was a signal to land, because they never had a fire before, big, you know. So he come down, landed right along close to the fire, and it was the roughest spot he could have found. And he busted the airplane up again, bad.
Oh. Sounds like there was a lot of work for you mechanics in those days.
Oh, yeah. Busted the landing gear off, knocked the cylinder off. Ski broke in the front of it, broke off, went up through the window. We had shock cords on it, you know, a heavy shock cord. And when the ski broke, the nose broke off, it bang, it come right back up into the window and bust the windshield.
Oh.
And pretty near hit him, too, by golly. It come pretty close.
Now, this fire that he landed at was at the Isles and crash site.
Yeah, that was at the where the airplane was found, yeah, Ben.
Well, so were you the one that had to go fix that?
Well, they sent a mechanic over first. Larson was his name. And Joe Crossan flew him over. And they had to take dog teams, all this stuff. They had a prop, cylinder, and quite a bit of repair stuff. So they didn't want to land down there for some reason or other. I don't know. So they took him down a dog team, 90 miles. And he spent time there, and he did all he could, and then he came back, and he said that they need the welder. The landing gear was pulled off, busted. So then I had to go again. I went over the second, and the second time I attempted to get over there, I made it. And we went over and fixed the airplane and landed there about, oh, I think we landed there in the morning, about 11 o'clock in the morning. And at 11 o'clock that night, we taxied the airplane up out of this hole and got it up on the ice and snow. And we covered it up and just sit there until about noon, when the weather got a little better, and 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we flew up the 9 o'clock.
Now, in all this time, you haven't gone back home to Fairbanks yet to say, here I am alive.
Yeah. No, I spent on the trip up that first time. I went home. I was there about 5 weeks, and then he sent me home. And I went home with a fellow named Swartman, and they wanted an airplane, what we had up there to use in Fairbanks. And so I went back with him, and I hadn't been home but about a week. Gosh darn it, I had to go again, you know. And I loaned all my fur goods, gear. I had, I had a good outfit. I had sealskin pants, Sparky, mucklucks, nice gloves and a cap. And I loaned them all to this guy Larson because he didn't have any. And I never did get them back.
Oh, my.
And I had to go over with just my regular duds on.
Oh.
I didn't have any Sparky. I had a Sparky, all right, but it wasn't sealskin.
Wasn't what you needed. We're going to be back in just a moment after we acknowledge a couple more of our sponsors. We're talking with Hutch on Meet a Pioneer.
The same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked-about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
I'm Dr. Carol Davis of the Denali Chiropractic Clinic, and I'm pleased to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. I'd like to tell you a little more about chiropractic. For instance, did you know that chiropractic is the world's largest drugless healing profession, with 17 chiropractic colleges in the United States? All have rigid admission standards and require several years of college study in the basic sciences and liberal arts. Chiropractic college is a four-year program that demands up to 40 hours a week of in-class time, studying subjects such as anatomy, physiology, clinical science, and, of course, techniques for adjusting the spine. Before a chiropractor graduates, she or he must serve an internship with an experienced doctor and then must meet licensing standards in all 50 states. Chiropractic care is covered by many insurance companies. If you'd like to find out more about chiropractic, call me at the Denali Chiropractic Clinic at 479-0485 or stop by 3525 College Road. And now, let's enjoy the rest of Meet a Pioneer.
We're back with Hutch on Meet a Pioneer. I'm Gail Malloy. We've got about 20 minutes left in our program. This is just fascinating, hearing all these stories, and I know there are more and more, but let's talk about Weeks Field and what was the outfit. Where did you work? What did it look like? There was a row of hangars, I guess, along 10th or... Uh-huh. Now, and you worked for Alaska Airways.
Yeah, Alaska Airways. We worked in the old Ween hangar. Ween's, you know, sold out to Alaska Airways, and that's where we moved into there. I worked out of there in 1929.
Now, you joined... Is that when you joined Alaska Airways, 1929?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. By the way, for all this... daring lifestyle, being a mechanic. What did you make? What did a man make doing that sort of work?
Make?
Yeah, how much did you make?
Oh, at working for the Alaska Airways, I made $225 a month.
Uh-huh. And how many days and hours was that?
Oh, well, you worked 6 days a week, you know. And you never did have any hours, really, You worked till your job was done. You had to come back at night or work Sundays or any old time. And I imagine 8 hours was about the limit then. But I know what you're trying to. I was talking to you about working at the Sampson.
Oh yeah. What'd you make
10
at
hours
Sampson?
A day, 6 days a week.
For
$120 a month.
50 cents an hour.
And I went over on Sundays and cleaned the shop out for nothing.
That's the way it was.
But
huh?
I was tickled to have a job. I didn't mind it.
Uh-huh.
It was good for me.
Yeah. Well, Weeksfield then, and you were in the Ween hangar then. Now, that was 10th Street.
Yeah, that's 10th, yeah.
That was lined with hangars?
That was the back of the hangars.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Weeksfield took in... from from the from Gillum's, not Gillum, but College Street, clear down to Barnett Street. And on Barnett Street, when we first started operating there, the NC Company had a railroad track all along Barnett Street. And they had a big 100-cord wood stacked on the end of the field. And, of course, the airplanes had to take off over these cords of wood, you know, in the wintertime and the summer, too. But the field originally was a racetrack sort of thing. And they had a grandstand and played ball there, and it was recreation. And The people that owned it, I understand, give it to the, for $1 a year, they let the city use it. And
what is now that big vacant lot there?
Yeah.
Okay.
That big vacant lot, there's nothing on it now.
Uh-huh.
Sure, if they don't turn it into some kind of an amusement deal or something for the city.
Uh-huh.
Why, it goes back to the original owners,
now, that's the land just north of the Noel Ween Library.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. So
now
they
that's
get...
east.
East?
Oh, no, this side. North, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Well,
so...
the library's on one edge of it.
I see.
And in later years, why, they did park airplanes over there.
Uh-huh. In 1934, you rebuilt a plane for Bill Lavery.
Yeah. That was a standard D-25, and I built that over at the old Fairbanks aircraft hangar on Cushman Street, right off Cushman Street. They had a field, you know, right from the corner, Gaffney and Cushman, that headed a little southeast. And Edwin Wilkins flew off of that. And they had another one from the Bismarck subdivision over there now. Crossed the Cushman Street and went, it was pretty long too. Mm-hmm. And they used that in the winter. In the summer, they didn't use it. They used the other one, the one from the corner of Cushman Street. And the weak field, though, when Hughes made his round the world trip, they extended the field clear down to Groudon Park. He'd have made a great big long field for that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then afterwards, everybody used that. And it went from Barnett Street clear down to where Groudon Park is right now, where to play ball.
Now that was later used by Wiley Post.
That's in the later year. Yeah.
Now what's that story? You met Wiley. Now Wiley Post had a reputation for an around-the-world record. Flying, is that correct?
Hughes.
Oh, Hughes, okay.
Hughes, yeah.
What?
Well, okay, Wiley Post, he flew into the regular field.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
They hadn't lengthened the field when he came in.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. I'm turned around there. Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. So it was for Bill Hughes that they had lengthened it.
Yeah.
For his round-the-world.
Yeah.
Gee whiz. Well, let's see. We've got several things I want to cover. I'm interested in talking about the World War II years here, because that certainly had, for a while, a major impact on Fairbanks.
Yeah, they put through quite a few airplanes, 5,000, I understand.
Now, what we learned earlier is that Ladd Field, or the base, was built not in anticipation of war, but as a cold weather testing station.
That's right.
Right before the war, which turned out to have been an opportune move. Now, Pearl Harbor, of course, was bombed in 1941, December 7th, and it wasn't long after that that the Japanese invaded the Aleutians.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
right.
And so you pick up the story here, then what happened in Fairbanks during all this time?
Well, we had, we had all kinds of problems. You know, we had up on the field, I was working for Frank Pollock down, and he had quite a few night mechanic good guys, and a few of them quit and went to work for Ladd Field, which they needed the mechanics, all right, they needed people out there, but General Gaffney, he got kind of perturbed about it, because the civil aviation was as important, he said, as building that field out there. So he came in and talked to a lot of us, had a meeting in the Pollock's hangar, and he said that it was important that we stay on the field instead of quitting and going out to work for the Army or the Air Corps, the engineers. And by golly, we had everybody that stayed there. They furnished ammunition for. I had a .30-06, and some of the other guys had big guns.
These are your own private guns?
Own private guns.
And the military supplied you ammunition for them?
Yeah, they give us some ammunition, and we kept our guns on the field.
Now what was that for?
Well, in case somebody came, you know.
The Japanese?
Yeah, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
But we had to block the field. Everybody on the field had a job to do in case of a fire, you know, when the siren went off. Well, we would, I was driving a little cat, and I would drive it out on the field and get under the thing with my gun. And guys would run out with their cars, and we'd block the field so they couldn't land.
The Japanese?
Know. Yeah.
If they had invaded, oh my goodness, and
but
you practiced
guns,
this.
The guns were for, probably for guys coming out of the airplanes, you know. parachutes?
You were under orders from General Gaffney that if Japanese started landing in parachutes, shoot you were off. Fire away.
Well, go at it.
And they gave you the ammunition. Oh, my word.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's many know about. I suppose there is. I know there's a few here.
Well, how did you feel? Were you afraid for your family and all being here with the possibility of invasion by foreign troops?
No, we didn't. I don't know. I never did worry too much about it.
Did other people?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them left the country. You sold out and away they went.
You mean they just closed their business, house, and left that quick?
Yeah. Quick.
How many people were living in Fairbanks about that time? What was the population about?
Well, when I came to Fairbanks, I might have about 1,200, something like that.
In 20-something, so by 41. There was a few,
Then right
thousand.
After the FE company moved in, you know, and then things perked up.
Oh, and then, of course, during the 30s, it kind of boomed.
No, I was 25, 26, 27. Uh-huh.
And then it picked up. Okay, well, that's amazing. Now, I understand you were asked to be a warden during this time. What did that involve?
Well, we had to go out at night and check, you know, see if people covered up their windows and in case of a air raid at night, had blackouts, you know.
Everybody had to shut their lights
off. Not necessarily. You had to cover up your windows.
Uh-huh.
And nothing on top, you know, no. They'd fly over at night and take a look.
Who did?
Well, the Army. If everybody was...
Our guys, yeah.
doing their stuff.
Uh-huh. And so you...
Civil... they called it something. I don't know. I can't remember. Civil something.
Now, you were... You carried a little flashlight around or something.
And I had to walk around my neighborhood down there and check out, see if everybody did their stuff, you know.
Huh. Now, the Russians were our friends at this time, our allies. And I understand that Fairbanks was a stop-off point for the delivery of American planes to the Russians.
Yeah.
A lot of planes.
They put 5,000 of them through here. And, they stayed pretty much on the base, I guess, and they'd come to town and buy stuff. They always had good American money.
The Russian guys had American money.
Yeah,
lots of it, huh? Could you tell a Russian, I mean, were they conspicuous when they did come into town?
No, I don't know. I never did bump into too many of them myself.
Uh-huh. So there wasn't too much association between those. No, they were just here to wait for the planes to get.
Well, they were going in and out like a yo-yo.
Now, where did the planes come from?
Well, Great Falls, maybe, outside.
And,
pursuit ships and bombers and...
Gee, and so we...
DC-3s.
Made in America, and the Russians would pick them up, and then what did they do with them?
Lend lease, or whatever it was.
Oh, yes, uh-huh. yeah.
Probably never got a dime out of
lend,
them.
Lend, right. Yeah. Okay, so, then they would pick them up and go on,
yeah.
Take them over to...
Go from here to Nome, I think.
I see.
Well, they stopped at Galena, too.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, maybe.
We're going to take a switch here from talking about aviation to some other things that you've done. You're well known for your singing.
Well, I sang a little, when I was a youngster. Yeah. Whiskey baritone, or tenor. Whiskey tenor.
Well, you know, we've all heard of barbershop quartets, but you really were in a real barbershop quartet. Tell us about it.
We just for our own satisfaction, though, Cully Whitner and his brother Paul had a barbershop close to the Model Cafe. And by golly, we used to go over there and sing and pull the blinds down and get back in there and sing. And we'd have a little audience out front once in a while, rap on the door, try to get in.
So, now, Cully was a baritone. Bryce Howard was the lead.
Yeah, he was the, Bryce Howard, if I remember right, was the Alaska Steamship Company agent here in Fairbanks.
Now, you were the tenor, and the bass was Ross?
Ross, yeah.
Ross.
I don't know, I can't remember his first name, but his wife was a school teacher.
Oh, I see.
He was a electrician, I think.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you really were a barbershop quartet. You practiced in the
barbershop. We were. Right in the barbershop. Sang in the barbershop.
Well, you used to sing with Don Adler.
Yeah, I sang at the Empress.
On Wednesday nights. Now, what was the deal for that? What was that about?
Well, it was more or less to try to get the audience to sing. And Don would pick out a pretty simple song, you know, and we'd practice there. And then he'd flash it on the screen, and I would sing it, and then he'd get all the people to sing it. Pretty quickly, we had everybody singing. It was pretty nice.
You mean the little bouncing ball deal?
Yeah, something like
Follow
that.
Follow the bouncing ball?
We didn't have the bouncing ball.
Huh.
We just put the, I suppose he taped it out and flashed it on the screen, the words.
Oh, my goodness. And so everybody'd sing along with
everybody
you.
Everybody singing along. It was great.
Don played the organ.
Played the organ. He loved it.
Gee whiz. Now, also, this is, I think this is just wonderful. You, when KFAR first went on the air, I think October 1st of 1939, you sang live on KFAR radio as part of the first day celebration.
Yeah. Well, I remember this distinctly. I had, I got a call from Don, came up and sang, and I was working down at the NC machine shop. So I had clothes there, and I brought my clothes from home, and I changed clothes there, and I come to work. Came, went up there to sing with a pair of shoe packs on. It was wintertime. And, golly, I felt pretty embarrassed getting out there in front of them people with a pair of shoe packs on, singing songs. And there was two or three other people on the program from Fairbanks.
And what did you sing? Do you remember?
No. Gosh, that's...
And that was over in the Lathrop building.
Yeah, that's the old Lathrop building.
KFAR should be. Gee whiz. Huh. That's pretty... tell me the... Well, we'll be back in just a moment with that story about the Easter Sunday story. We'll be back with Hutch in just a moment.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not Shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items, so for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself. Remember, the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square.
Today's Alaskans are demanding more. More style, more options, more flexibility, and more for their money. And they're finally getting it from Sophie's Station, Fairbanks' newest, most attractive contemporary living complex. Sophie's Station is a prestigious addition to our community, designed for optimum quality, comfort, and convenience. For adult living at its best, see the new 1- and 2-bedroom units, now available at Sophie's Station.
We thank all of our fine sponsors who help make Meet a Pioneer possible. Well, we're back with Hutch. We've got 5 minutes left, Hutch. Tell me the story about... you were supposed to sing for an Easter Sunday service.
Oh, that was, yeah, that was at the Presbyterian Church, and we'd been practicing this Easter music for quite a while, and Bill Avery had a pilot bust up his airplane over at Deadwood. That's over in the Circle Country, and he wanted me to fix it up so he could get use out of it. So I told him, I said, geez, I gotta sing at this program, Bill. Well, he said, that ain't no big deal. I'll take you over there early and I'll get you back in time. So we left here about 4 o'clock in the morning. I was working at the NC machine shop then too. And we left here about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was in the spring. And they were on skis over there. And I had built a part of a landing gear in the shop and took with us. And I put it on the airplane over there and welded it up, put some gussets on it, monkeyed around, put skis on, hooked up shock cord. And Albert Peterson, he was going to fly it back. So we waited till he got in the air, and then Bill and I took off. Well, I got back to town here. I had to run home, had to take a bath, change my clothes, and I had to get up to the church, you know. Well, we walked in those days. We didn't have cars running around too much. And I had to walk from the house up to the Presbyterian church, and I got there just as the choir was going into the church there. And Annabeth Rennie was a leader, and she was just having a fit. And I had all the solos to sing, the tenor solos in this big deal. And here I come walking in, and I had to put on a gown and all the stuff, and then I walked in. And she had a conniption fit. She didn't like it at all.
Oh, I can certainly imagine. Well, you sang the Winter Carnival song.
Yeah.
Do you remember that song? Will you sing it for me?
Yeah, I sang it for you.
Sing it for me now.
Okay, well, now listen, this is pretty early for a tenor to be singing a whiskey tenor anyway. Isn't it?
That's all right.
Yeah.
Let's hear a few bars.
Okay. Come out and play, let's join the carnival. Come out and play, we're pleasure bound. Winter's here and spring is on its way. One and all, you hear the song, hey, hey. Say farewell to blues. Spread the news all around the town. Get together, never mind the weather. Come out and play. Yeah.
Wonderful, Hutch.
Well,
Thank you.
Now, that song was written by, the words were written by Mrs. Huffman, Doc Huffman's wife, and Mrs. Murray, and Don put the music to it.
Gee whiz.
And I sang it at the Emperor's Theater. And we got people going on that.
I'm charmed. You've been a wonderful guest on Meet a Pioneer this morning. I'm so glad. Well, here you are. Let's see. That was 39. This is 84. 45 years later. Yes. You are singing again on KFAR Radio. What a pleasure.
Yeah.
It's been nice to have you here. Mm-hmm. Hutch, James T. Hutchison, Sr., our guest on Meet a Pioneer, and certainly a pioneer in Alaskan aviation history. What's it feel like to be a pioneer, Hutch?
Well, you know, this pioneer business has always been a kind of a thing with me. I knew all these old pioneers that were up here, you know, came in the early days, and I've always felt a little bit funny about being called a pioneer. Because the pioneers were supposed to have been come over the Chilcot Pass and monkeyed around Dawson and Nome. And here I come in 1920. I come in 1919, but I was in the Army. I didn't have to work. I got paid a dollar a day. It wasn't too bad, $30 a month. But Pioneer Aviation, I was in on that. That's what I go on. And being a real good old full-fledged pioneer like some of these guys that come in 1904, 1906, heck, I was just a youngster then. I'm glad to be a pioneer.
You've been listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaska and Polar Regions Department
at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
Forward and during kind of ultimate to hot spot area, you know, that is dealing with problems and words that we wanted and we hope that
it was reported earlier that I'm an area of reason.